narrations have been taken from a weekly column appearing in the St. John Valley Times. These have been written by members of the Madawaska Historical Society, and the readings are being done by Mrs. Geraldine Chassie, President of the Society, on November 17, 1971. When the first Acadian settlers arrived to the Madawaska Territory in 1785, there already existed a small trading post operated by two French-Canadian gentlemen by the name of Pierre Duperrey and Pierre Lizotte. Mr. Lizotte, we are told, after having spent the winter with the Maliseet Indians, had returned home to induce his half-brother Pierre to return with him to set up the trading enterprise. Both men were already established in business when Joseph Daigle and the Acadian Convention set up a crude cross on the south shore of the St. John River in thanksgiving for their safe arrival. Several years later, when the lumber barons from the Kennebec River Valley arrived to the Madawaska Territory, both gentlemen were highly respected by both the Americans and the Canadians, and were more or less spokesmen for both groups. The following letter was given to us by a Mrs. Alex Bernard, resident of the Indian Reservation in Iroquois, New Brunswick. The letter is dated February 20th, 1818. Honorable Sir, in answer to your letter of the 8th of January last, I have sent you particular accounts of the Americans who have taken up their residence in the Madawaska settlement. Captain Nathan Baker came to Madawaska 12 months ago. At that time, he wished to introduce the laws of the states, brought a magistrate along with him from the states to form a corporation. He desired my concurrence, but I told him I would have nothing to do with such matters before the lines were settled between the British government and the states. I likewise told the rest of the French settlers not to have anything to do with him about such matters, which they did. In August last, he brought his wife and family from the Kennebec River Valley and took his residence in the upper settlement of Madawaska and built a house. In the beginning of October, he began to timber, and with five men took his range for wood through 10 lots, on all of which there are settlers, and some of them were established 15 years ago. Here he made considerable improvement. Some of the inhabitants forbade him to cut wood on their lots. He said it did not belong to them, but to the states. He has already about 10 or 12 tons of lumber, a great part of which I saw on the 19th of February upon the banks of the St. John River on the north side. He, Captain Nathan Baker, appears to be a man who takes upon much upon himself. In August last, Captain Fletcher came from the States and entered into partnership with him in the lumber trade. John Hafford came from the States with his wife and family at the same time and took up his residence in the upper settlement of the Madawaska. He built a home and is carrying improvement on his land. Likewise, his son George Hafford and his wife and family settled beside father and built a house and is improving his lot. About 2 months ago, they came down to make shingles at the mouth of the Madawaska River. An area belonging to the Indians. But he will return to his to the settlement when the river opens to plant his spring crop. In the last of September, George Johnson, one of the American surveyors, made a survey upon the north side of the St. John River, beginning at the mouth of the Madawaska River up to the St. Francis River. He measured the French settlement at the same time. If you want any more information respecting these or other matters, I shall be happy to give you all the information in my power. Respectfully yours, Honorable Pierre Duperrey. Perry.
The large white pine of the Madawaska Territory attracted lumber barons from both the United States and Great Britain. The first American to arrive from the Kennebec Valley were Captain Nathan Baker, who started the first gristmill on Baker Brook. He was followed by his brother John and men by the name of Hafford, Wheelock, Bacon, Studson, Hunnewell, Power, Savage, Bartlett, Webster, and Murdoch. Upon the death of Nathan Baker, John married his widow, Sophia Rice Baker, and continued the lumbering enterprise. John Baker, as an American, could not use his own name. Any land in New Brunswick, so to get around this technicality, his friends from Woodstock, Samuel Nevers, had the deed to his land. Baker's talents and activities soon made him the spokesman for the Yankee American Republic of Madawaska. He began to spread American propaganda that the land he held and all surrounding land belonged to Maine. To legalize his American civil status, he asked and received from the legislature the deed and the title of his land. The New Brunswick government protested by taxing all foreigners and seizing all the lumber cut by them. General John Baker, in 1827, in retaliation, invited all his friends to a 4th of July celebration to sign a declaration of fidelity to the American Republic. The stars and stripes were hoisted in the midst of cheers of approval. The day ended with a banquet and much merrymaking. On August 10th, Marshal George Morehouse of New Brunswick appeared at the Baker residence inquiring about the flag. To which Mr. Baker replied, "This is the American flag. Have you never seen it? In that case, you may examine it in your leisure." On an order given by the magistrate to bring the flag to him, Baker proudly replied, "I'd never do such a thing. We placed it there, and there it shall stay. We are on American soil, and will be upheld by our government." The British cut down the flagpole and took the flag to Fredericton. Mrs. Baker, being as stubborn as her husband, went to St. Basile to buy more cloth to make another flag and had it up in no time again. In the meantime, Baker and his friends were accused of revolting against the English, and on September 25, the capital of Baker Brook was overrun by police, and Baker and companions were fined and condemned to 3 months' imprisonment in the Fredericton jail. The lawmen had no sooner left when the flag of independence was again fluttering in the breeze. Mrs. Baker, as a good American, had taken over. Letters of protest were written by Maine officials to federal government in Washington. An answer from the Secretary of State Henry Clay to Governor Enoch Lincoln stated that New Brunswick authorities should liberate Mr. Baker and friends, or the American troops would intervene. It was not until the troops were sent to Holton and building of the military road at St. John Valley were the Americans released. Mr. Baker continued to become involved in local politics, and once more Acadian Americans were jailed. He informed the state legislature of what was happening in the Madawaska Territory, which continued to aggravate the boundary situation until Fort Kent and Fort Fairfield were built in preparation for an all-out war. It was at this time Washington was forced to take action in what resulted in the Webster-Ashburton Treaty of 1842. The St. John River was made the international boundary, with the south side being American and the north British, leaving the river open to both countries and terminating the bloodless rustic war. Ironically, this made Mr. Baker a Canadian citizen, which he never conceded to, but learned to live with it. Several years after his death, his remains were transferred to Fort Fairfield by the state of Maine to honor its hero. The following column was written in Madawaska, 1969, in tribute to the founder of Fraser's. Among the distinguished citizens that our community is paying homage to during our 100th anniversary, there is no doubt that Donald Fraser, by buying the Murchie Mill in 1911, has had a far-reaching influence in the development of Madawaska. Actually, it was merely due to a quirk of fate that Donald Fraser and family were aboard the ship Castalia in Firth of Clyde, Glasgow, Scotland, in the spring of 1873. Coming from a family active in the lumber business for two generations, young Donald had intended sailing to Sweden, where he had accepted a position with a lumber firm. After disposing of his property and settling his affairs, word came that a fire had completely destroyed the Swedish properties and Donald's prospect for a new future in another land. This was only temporary, however, for news of a plan for the colonization of New Brunswick, Canada, appealed to him. Instead of sailing for Sweden, he and his family, Donald, then a young man of 31, his wife Anne Reith Fraser, 27, their two sons, Donald Jr., 6, and Archibald, 4, sailed for Canada. Approximately 17 days after leaving Scotland, they reached St. John, New Brunswick, where they were warmly greeted by earlier settlers. Although the colonists had arrived in good health, the cold spring, late snow in the woods, was disheartening to men who had to make roads, clear land, build homes, and put in a crop. Many hardships were encountered, but these staunch people endured. In 1874, the first statistical records list Donald Fraser's family properties at an estimated value of $329.50, broken down as follows. A complete home dwelling, 3 acres chopped, 5 acres cropped, 1 cow, 1 swine, 100 bushels of grain, 70 bushels of potatoes, 10 bushels of buckwheat, 30 bushels of turnips, and so forth. Fundamentally, Donald was not a farmer, but for the first 4 years in the New World, his efforts were spent meeting the necessities of the moment and promoting the immediate welfare of his family. He bought his first mill at River des Chutes in 1877. This simple beginning was the nucleus of the Fraser success. He went on to acquire a lumbering enterprise which consisted of the following: Munich Mills in 1878, Aberdeen Mills in Fredericton, New Brunswick in 1894, Cabaneau Mills in 1899, and the Murchie Mill in Edmondson in 1911, which developed into the sulfate pulp mill in Edmondston. This eventually led to the building of the Madawaska paper mill in 1925. As of 1925, the Fraser name became a part of our community, and we all know the outcome. Madawaska residents make up a large part of the labor force now employed by Fraser Paper Company. Like most of these great pioneers who started their career with little capital, other than a strong constitution, determined will, eminently keen and practical mind, and an unlimited capacity for hard work. The industrial success of Donald Fraser was built step by step through his vision and alertness and the courage to move ahead as the opportunities presented itself. Although an immigrant to Canada, the citizens of Madawaska, Maine feel that Donald Fraser has earned a special place among the distinguished citizens of our community. Peter Keegan, Sage of the St. John Valley. History of the St. John Valley and the state of Maine characterized Peter Keegan in the early 1900s as the Sage of the St. John Valley. His ability as a lawyer, publicist, political leader, his long service in the Maine legislature, and his numerous and varied activities generally are well known to Maine people. So reads Sprague's Journal of Maine History, 1913-1914. It goes on to say, Peter Charles Keegan, the name is a slogan whose sharp, cornered syllables explode with the barking staccato of a machine gun. Withal, there is a note of old-fashioned honesty in it, a breath of fresh air at open places. You feel instinctively that here is a man worth trying to. A sturdy figure with head set solidly upon a pair of heavy shoulders, a square jaw beneath the overhang of mustache, the fire of the deep-set black eyes tell of things done and well done, it continues. He was born and died in Van Buren, the son of James Keegan, farmer, constable, register of deeds. He married Mary Sharkey of Fredericton. They adopted a son, the late Harold Birchall Keegan, whose wife, Mrs. Lillian Keegle, still resides in Van Buren. The comfortable, stately, and gracious Keegan home was destroyed by fire in 1961. It stood on a hill, part of the home farm where he was born. From the pine-shadowed veranda, a superb view of the beautiful St. John River and the valley opened northward. His parents, my great-grandparents, were pioneers in the valley. In the day, a few people united to hire a teacher, the term running as long as the money held out. Uncle Charles went to such a school at the age of 4. When he was 9, the only school within his reach of the Keegan home was across the river in New Brunswick. With his dinner pail, he paddled across in a dugout and walked 2 miles to the schoolhouse, returning the same way at night. 3 years later, the nearest schoolhouse was 3.5 miles away, and he walked the distance twice a day. At the age of 15, he entered the University of New Brunswick in Fredericton, winning second highest place in his entrance examination. He graduated with honors in a class which had among its members a number of men who later became eminent in Canadian government affairs. College was followed by a period of law study, then admission to the bar. He practiced law in his native town. He was instrumental in bringing St. Mary College to the town and getting the Bangor and Aroostook Railroad for the valley. He was president of the Van Buren Trust Company for many years. In a Bangor and Aroostook Railroad Company publication of 1902 in Fair Aroostook, the author Clarence Poulin wrote, "The irrepressible energy of the presiding genius of the place, progressive and energetic and genial Peter Charles Keegan, is equal to the overcoming of all obstacles." And at the time of my visit to Van Buren, he was closing the arrangements with a company for the building of the waterwork in the town. It is good that Van Buren has an area called Keegan, so that not only history books remind us of this capable, respected man who loved and did so much for the valley. May it live up to his expectation. Among the dedicated people who gave their talents and energies to the St. John Valley, many will agree that Senator Patrick Theriault contributed a lion's share. I approached his daughter, Sister Mary Carmel, principal of St. John Baptist Regional School in Bangor, for information about Mr. Theriault. The letter I received could never be improved upon. Please forgive me, Sister, for publishing a personal letter. It is too admirable not to be shared. Dear Mrs. Chassie, it is easy to talk about my father. He was my idol. There are people living along the valley who knew my father who could give you more impartial information, namely Mrs. Amboise Albert and Dr. Francis Foshee of Grand Isle. Patrick Theriault was born in Van Buren, April 18, 1875. He attended and graduated from what was then St. Mary's College in Van Buren. He married Zelia Morneau from Grand Isle and lived in Van Buren when they were first married. I don't know when they moved to Lille, but I was born there. He was a state senator from 1906 to 1908. My first recollections of my father was that he was a superintendent of schools. That was before I went to school, and I remember going with him to visit schools in our sleigh driven by our horse Nellie. The territory for the superintendent was from Van Buren as far as Fort Kent, not including either district. I remember especially the convent in St. Agatha, where the delicious French food was served. Les Filles de la Sagesse came to Lille in 1906, and I remember being told that they lived in the house which we vacated when we moved to our new home across the church. The sisters lived there until the convent was built some years later. Mr. and Mrs. Patrick Sear now occupy the new house in which I was brought up. As far back as I can remember, my father was always bringing home blind children whom he took to the Perkins Institute in Boston, and deaf mutes to be taken to the school for the deaf in Portland. He discovered these children along the valley as he went around visiting schools. In Sinclair there is a school named the Patrick Theriault School, which was built in the early 50s. When Mr. Brennick, then the State Department of Education, came to Portland to ask me about naming the school after my father, I was pleased and surprised that people still remembered him. I do not know how long my father was county commissioner, but it was for several years. During that time, I know he did a great deal for the valley, especially for education. I went away to school in 1917, first to St. Mary's Academy in Houlton. My father was county commissioner and came to Houlton for the meetings. These were thrilling days for me. I attended St. Joseph's Academy in Portland, and during my senior year, my father died suddenly on April 25, 1921, while talking with some of the men on a road construction in St. David. With my father's death, all of our plans for my education also died. My mother died in 1930 with my brother in limestone. Of course, my father did not make a living teaching school, being superintendent, senator, county commissioner, and helping everyone that came to him from help. We had a store in Lille, which my mother's thrift and good management kept going. Otherwise, life would not have been too easy for us. Sincerely, Sister Mary Carmel. However, what Sister Mary Carmel did not mention is that Senator Terrio was instrumental in obtaining documents, manuscripts, and records from the state archives for the Reverend Thomas Albert History of Madawaska, published in 1920. As we celebrate our 100th anniversary, we are reaping the fruit of this dedicated man's labor. The French missionaries come to the St. John Valley. This article was written by Sister Rose and Rossignol, who was killed in a car accident in 1970. The people over 50 years of age would certainly be somewhat bewildered if the organizing committee of the centenary of Madawaska would not present a memorandum to the Reverend Father Charles Swaddle, tireless missionary priest of the St. John Valley. Yes, this passionate apostle has ministered for half a century on both the U.S. and Canadian side of the river from 1857 to 1908. During this last of time, our zealous apostle had known no rest, but had given the best of his priestly life to the welfare of the souls of the Acadian population. Father Swaddle arrived from Belgium in 1857 and was stationed by His Excellency Bishop Sweeney of St. John at St. Francis Parish Priest, meanwhile ministering all along the coast down to Van Buren, a territory which presently comprises of 14 parishes. Had our young and enthusiastic missionary enough work to satisfy his thirst for souls? After reading these short historical notes, it will be up to you to decide. He obviously had a face of an arduous, he obviously had to face an arduous task that of communication in this particular era confided to him. Canoeing up and down the St. John River was the sole means of transportation at his disposal. In spite of all difficulties, people would see at irregular intervals an oared canoe coming, a boat propelled by Father Swaddle's sturdy arms or those of a guide when available. He would stop at determined posts, bringing registers up to date, where he would baptize the newly born children, bless married couples, hear confessions, celebrate the holy sacrifice of the Mass, distribute communion, and reserve for himself a special time to visit the poor and the suffering. It is on these occasions that he revealed his power to cure the sick, who did possess a deep faith in God's omnipotence. In 1859, a small parish of St. Louis of Frenchville, Maine, had the honor and privilege of having this holy priest for almost half a century, that is, 1859 till his death in 1908. He nevertheless remained missionary of the above named regions. With great respect and veneration, the old people presently living loved to relate the heroic acts of self-denial accomplished by their ardent and courageous priest. His zeal knew no bounds for the spread of religion Christ on earth. I quote an old parishioner, Mass on Sunday would begin at 9 a.m. by the recitation of the Rosary, followed by the Holy Sacrifice of the Mass. The words of God would kindle in his heart a fiery zeal unheard of then. The whole ceremony would last till noon, yet no one complained because Father Swaddle's works were considered sacred to all. Whenever he would speak to us about the end of man, that is death, judgment, heaven, hell, and the length of eternity, we would shiver. He ingrained into the souls of his audience such profound faith
that after a century the clergy in charge of the parishes evangelized by this holy priest can say, "Ah, the people of the St. John Valley have kept the faith transmitted to them by Father Suero." Do the members of the clergy say this through humility in order to conceal their apostolic labor, or is it really the seed sown by our great apostles, similar to Father Mario and St. John Vianney, better known as Le Saint Curé d'Ars? In 1899, Father called in his parish the Sisters of the Holy Rosary of Rimouski, Quebec, to teach in his parochial schools in Frenchville. In 1906, at the advance of 78, he began the construction of a church, convent, and rectory, and three buildings had been razed to the ground by fire the preceding year. Death found him in full activity just as he was completing the last building. The rectory, it was a strenuous task, but he saw it completed before God called him to his eternal rest. He was 80 years of age. He is gone, but the seeds thrown in the furrow will remain for the future generations, never to be forgotten. The just will stand with assurance before the Lord. So will Reverend Father Charles Swaddle. History of the Mount Carmel Chapel made available from the Catholic Chancery of Portland, Maine. When the Webster-Ashburton Treaty of 1842 terminated the bloodless Aroostook War by clearly defining our northern boundary, the American section of Madawaska on the south side of the St. John River remained under the jurisdiction of bishops of the Canadian Maritime Provinces. Immediately, the inhabitants clamored for union with the closest U.S. diocese, Boston giving as a reason the political division of the two countries henceforth separated from all other administration. At that time, there already existed just across St. Basil, New Brunswick, a tiny mission known as Carmel. Its exact origin is rather hazy. Some claim intervention from above. The Blessed Virgin desiring on Madawaska soil a sanctuary reminiscent of Lourdes or Laredo. Others talk of opposition by a group of Mad Content who stubbornly called for severing all ties with their fellow Acadians across the river. What is certain that in 1846, Bishop Fenwick of Boston marked the site of the Mount Carmel Chapel. 2 years later, on the feast of Our Lady of Mount Carmel, Bishop Fitzpatrick dedicated the sanctuary under the title of Notre Dame du Mont Carmel. In 1853, under the shadows of the same rolling river hills between what is now Grand Isle and St. David, Maine, Father Langevin, pastor of St. Basil, New Brunswick, built the first church in the valley. The location, however, ill-suited the people from St. David and those further down the river. Consequently, scaffolding was never removed, and Mount Carmel Church, with its whimsical decor, left a strange impression to the chance passerby. The struggle for complete separation waxed strong, and in 1864, the Association of Aroostook Catholics made a direct appeal to His Holiness Pope Pius IX. This petition bore 1,800 signatures. 6 years later, a decree of propaganda signed by Cardinal Barnabo put an end to the agitation. The south bank of the St. John River was placed under the authority of His Excellency David W. Bacon, first Bishop of Portland. At this time, the whole region boasted two parishes, both of which were served by Father Suero. The first written recorded record of baptism in Mount Carmel, dated March 4, 1869, is entered in his handwriting. Mount Carmel's joys knew no bounds, and in token of their esteem and appreciation, these hardy woodsmen and pioneer farmers offered their new bishop the fleetest trotter in the district. Vilma Chassé, the owner, remarked, "I raised it myself, and you will never find its like between the two falls." Short-lived was the joy, however, since Mount Carmel site no longer answered the needs of the people, and the parish church and center was transferred in 1871 to the permanent parish of St. David. Thus disappeared the old chapel with its bizarre architecture. A rustic cross is used to mark the spot which even today is called God's Acre. New difficulties cropped up with this latest arrangement. Things were hard for the parishioners 15 to 20 miles distant. The long and short of it was the erection of a second church in Lille in 1876. This part was a compromise in an attempt to placate those living at both extremities of the new parish. Time was needed to heal old wounds and settle differences. When Father Swadon arrived on Sunday morning to celebrate Mass, the church bell was silent, its hammer gone. Were it not returned for the following Sunday, direly warned the pastor, the culprit would die maintenant. When next Sunday dawned, the bell hammer lay on the church step. No funeral was announced.